weekend. I was in New York. You may be aware there was a big science result announced yesterday evening. Anyone knows what it is? What? Yes. So the balance has shifted. I am now close to winning $200 from Stephen Hawking. He, as you know, bet in favor of inflation. Inflation predicted gravitational waves from the Big Bang. It was a huge hullabaloo in February. And I was very skeptical. And unfortunately, though I was excited, I wished it were true. Unfortunately, it turned out that dust is the most likely culprit. Planck satellite did a very careful study, and the level of the dust, worth looking at their paper, the level of the dust matches exactly the signal from BICEP. So that's rather sad. It doesn't mean that we won't get data about the Big Bang. It just means we'll have to work harder. So because the dust is there, those of you who know, who've read about inflation know that there's this famous number R, which is the ratio of gravitational waves to scalar perturbations coming out of the early universe. A priori, there's no reason why R should be small. If you get scalar perturbations, you'd expect to get tensor perturbations as well, but it turned out that a certain class of pre-Big Bang theories, theories with bounces, predict zero for this number. And so we always claim this as a falsifiability. It's possible to falsify them. Whereas inflation, it's a very adjustable theory, can more or less get anything. Some models of inflation were giving R of about 0.1. And so when the observations came in claiming there was gravitational waves, people were cock-a-hoop and thought we're seeing the Big Bang and so on. Unfortunately, it wasn't a very careful experiment. They didn't have enough data to exclude foregrounds. And in fact, they claimed R of 0.2. Now it seems that the dust foregrounds are at almost exactly this level. So the most likely possibility is they've just seen dust. That's not the end of the road. It just means the experimentalists have to work much, much harder. And you can eliminate the dust using multi-frequency experiments. And they hope they will go down to R of 0.01 over the next 3 to 5 years. So it's still pretty exciting. But my bet with Stephen is that R... He claimed he'd won. So I said, I'm going to be generous. If it's bigger than 0.05, you win. But if it's less than 0.05, then I win. So there's $200 resting on this. Canadian dollars. He was a bit mean. But anyway, so that's... it's quite exciting. It's sort of negative progress this today. So I just showed you a movie of the perihelion shift. I didn't show the perihelion shift. I showed you the orbit of a star around the claimed black hole in the center of our galaxy, whose mass is 2 million solar masses. And so now we're just going to continue working out what the perihelion shift was. So you will recall that we wrote down g mu nu u mu u nu equals minus 1 because this orbiting object is a massive particle. And then we wrote down two conserved quantities, the energy and the angular momentum. The energy was curved because the metric is static, the short shell metric static, time independent. So that leads to conservation of energy. It's also independent of azimuthal angle phi, and that leads to the conservation of angular momentum. And so we ended up with this equation that r dot squared, dot is always d by d tor, r dot squared minus r Schwarzschild over r plus j squared over r squared minus r Schwarzschild j squared over r cubed equals constant. And so this is the kinetic energy of the orbiting object. This is gravitational potential energy. This is the angular momentum barrier. And this is the extra term. This is the extra term in GR, which we discussed last time is due to the warping of space. So we want to solve this equation. Actually, I drew the potential for this, you'll remember. The effective potential looks like this. So there are two circular orbits at r equals constant, and everything else is either roughly elliptical or hyperbolic. It can come in and bounce off to infinity. So now we want to solve this and try to see what's the influence of this term on the orbits of the planets around the sun. Now there's a nice feature of Newtonian theory is that the orbits are elliptical and they're exactly periodic, right? A star just keeps tracing out the same ellipse. And we'll see why right now. Because what is useful to do is to eliminate tau. I mean, after all, if you want the shape of the orbit, you don't care about tau. It's just a parameter along the curve. Much nicer to express r in terms of phi, which is the angle, because those two things are really r of phi determines the shape of the curve in space. Okay? So let's determine the shape of the curve. So we'll define prime to be d by d phi. And then r prime is r dot over phi dot. Right? Dr d tau over d phi d tau. Now, d phi d tau we know from j, because j was r squared phi dot. Okay, so this is equal to r squared over j. So now I can eliminate r dot in terms of r prime. Okay, so this whole equation becomes r prime squared over r to the fourth j squared. Just from here, r dot is r prime times j over r squared. So square it, and we'll get this term. And then we have everything else as before. Okay, and now there's a clever change of variables you can do, which is to notice that all of these things involve inverse powers of r. And the first term is just d by d phi of 1 over r squared. Okay, so if we define u as 1 over r, then this becomes, I'm going to multiply through by, divide through by j squared. So it's u prime squared minus rsu over j squared plus u squared minus rsu cubed equals constant. Okay, so this equation will determine u of phi, and u of phi will determine r of phi, and that's the that'll determine the shape of the curve in real space. So If I forget about the Einstein correction, what can you say about these three terms? If you think about phi as a time variable, okay, this is a kinetic energy, what would you say about the potential energy as a function of u? You think of u as the coordinate of a particle. No, it goes like u squared. So think about that term on its own. Forget about this one. What is that equation? If I write down x dot squared plus x squared equals constant. Pardon? Oscillator, harmonic oscillator, right? So what happens if I add a linear term in x? Does it make any difference? No, this is the energy, not the equation of motion. That's the potential energy, right? So if I have x squared, it looks like this. This is x. What happens if I add a linear term? What's the shape of the potential energy? How has it changed? Right, so basically the minimum shifts to minus c over 2, and the value, the value goes down because the x is negative. So there's that. But it's still a harmonic oscillator, right? Just the center point has shifted. Okay, so this these terms describe a shifted simple harmonic oscillator. And so those terms are very easy to solve. Okay, so the first three terms are a simple harmonic oscillator, and we know what the solution is for those terms. So for those three terms, and this is Newton's solution of elliptical orbits, U would equal to, well, obviously the minimum of the potential plus a cosine or a sine, right? That would be the harmonic oscillator. So the minimum of the potential is at u equal to rs over 2j squared, rs over 2j squared. And then we write it this way, 1 plus e cosine phi. Okay, so this is the minimum of the simple harmonic oscillator potential, and this is the oscillation about the minimum. Okay, so even though this isn't really a harmonic oscillator and u is really 1 over r and phi is an angle, just because the equation looks like a harmonic oscillator, it's a useful trick to solve it. And it's actually a useful trick to think about it. That when you solve this equation, it's basically a perturbed harmonic oscillator. This I'm going to call U naught. This is the Newtonian solution. Notice that it's exactly periodic, as I said. As phi changes from 0 to 2 pi, this quantity u, which is 1 over r, returns to itself. Right? That means that the orbit traces exactly the same ellipse, same shape, as it goes around the sun. Every orbit is identical to the one before. And if you trace that back, it's because the coefficient here is 1. Okay? The frequency in phi, angular frequency in phi, is 1. That means that the function is periodic in phi with period 2 pi. Where does that come from? Well, if you trace it back, this term comes from there, right? So this is just a property of motion in flat space. You have essentially r dot squared plus r squared phi dot, squared as the kinetic energies, and then you replace this with angular momentum because it's conserved. And when you do that, the motion is exactly periodic. Now, you then come along and perturb it with the Newtonian potential, okay? So you could mess up that periodicity if this was any other function. But it just so happens the Newtonian potential turns into a linear function of u, which is the variable which is harmonic, okay? Because it's a linear function of u, all it does is shift the minimum of the potential, doesn't change the period. Okay, so this is a very special property of Newtonian gravity, one over r force, is that it leaves the orbits periodic. Orbits are periodic in phi. Okay, it's a very beautiful property of one over r potentials. But by the same token, when I add anything else, it's going to mess that up. Anything else but a 1 over r potential is going to leave you with orbits which are not periodic, which will precess. I'm going to go around the sun, but there's absolutely no reason for the orbit to repeat. And so all that term does, so this is a perturbation to the potential V of u, which causes the orbit to precess. Okay, so Einstein realized this, and he realized his theory was not going to give periodic orbits, and so he worked out the precession. Now, there's rather a nice way to think about the precession, which is the following. There's an important property of the precession, which is that it grows with time. Okay, so it's not just a perturbation, it's a growing perturbation. And to see that, so in fact, the perturbation of the solution grows in the solution. Grows with phi. By the way, I didn't write this down, but I can easily write from here that r is equal to 1 over u, which is 2j squared over rs, 1 plus e cos phi. And this is the equation for an ellipse in polar coordinates, right? When phi is 0, the radius is as small as possible. So that would be here, phi is this angle. The radius is small as possible when phi is 0, if e is positive. E is the ellipticity. And when phi is pi, this denominator is 1 minus e, so the radius is as big as possible. And basically, the shape of the orbit is that. Okay, so this distance is 1 over 1 plus e times stuff. And this distance is 1 over is stuff times 1 over 1 minus e. So it's an ellipse. And phi equals 0 is called a perihelion. It's the closest point of approach of the ellipse to the focus here. So, in fact, the perturbation grows with phi. And the reason for this is that this equation describes resonance. Okay, for some reason, this is not really explained in the books. I don't know why. But this is the key to why this perihelion shift grows. And to see that, if you differentiate this equation, let's call it star. And then everything is going to be proportional to u prime. So throw away the u prime. And I'll throw away the factor of 2 as well. Then what I get is, just differentiating it, I get u double prime equals minus u minus rs over 2j squared. That's our simple harmonic oscillator. Okay, the usual, this is the deviation of u from the minimum of the potential. And differentiating this term, I get a factor of 3. And so on the right-hand side, it's plus 3rs u squared over 2, because divided by 2 from differentiating u prime squared. Okay, so we have a simple harmonic oscillator centered on rs over 2j squared with the driving force going like u squared. Now, what I'm going to do is assume this term is small. Okay? And essentially, it's small because it depended on 1 over c squared. If you went back and put the units in, this term was down by 1 over c squared. So this term is small, and so it's a small perturbation. So the way we'll solve it is we'll set u equal to u naught, that solution over there, plus delta u, a small perturbation. And we'll solve to linear order in delta u. In delta u. So because this term is small, I can treat it as a source. And so what I have is delta u double prime. U naught, of course, solves this equation. And so if I plug this into there, the u naught term terms all cancel, and what I get is the delta u terms. But then from here, I'm going to plug in u naught. And so that leads to the equation delta u double prime is equal to minus delta u plus 3/8 rs cubed over j to the 4th 1 plus e cos phi squared. Okay, so here, this is just a driven simple harmonic oscillator. And the key point to notice is that the driving force, if you expand this out, includes a constant. Well, a constant doesn't do much to a harmonic oscillator. It'll just shift the minimum, shift the center of the oscillations. The cosine squared term is a term, well, this is going to give terms which are constant, which oscillate at frequency 1, angular frequency 1, and which oscillate at angular frequency 2, right? The frequency 1 and frequency 0 and frequency 2 terms don't do anything much. But the frequency 1 term does something spectacular because it's resonant. Okay? So the only important term in here, so this gives 1 plus 2 e cos phi plus e squared cos squared phi. Of course, cos squared phi has frequency 2 and frequency 0. But as I said, neither of those do much. The term which does everything is this guy, which creates a resonance. Okay, because you're driving the harmonic oscillator at its own frequency. And that causes the motion to grow and grow. And so the only term you need to worry about is that term, and so that goes like delta u plus 3/4 rs cubed over j to the 4th e cosine phi. And for that equation, it's easy to find the particular integral represented at which the particular integral is given by delta U is equal to 3RS cubed over 8J to the fourth E phi sine phi. Okay, so obviously if I differentiate this guy twice, differentiating the sine, I'm going to get a term which cancels this exactly. Differentiating the phi twice gives nothing. But I also get twice the derivative of this times the derivative of that, which is exactly this term. And here's the resonance, this growing with phi. Oh, is that board still broken? I seem to have disconnected it. Okay, that's one solution. Sorry about that. So in fact, we have we can write the solution. So U is equal to U naught, which was up there, RS over 2J squared times 1 plus E cos phi. And then there's a perturbation here, the growing term RS cubed over 8J to the fourth E phi sine phi. And this is small. The last term is small. At least the magnitude of it is small, but it grows, right? The amplitude grows with phi. And so one can represent that in the following way. This is called secular growth. It means that for every period of the oscillation, the term gets larger and larger. But we can just absorb this term in here by shifting the argument. So 1 plus E cosine, and then 1 minus epsilon times phi. You see where epsilon is equal to 3RS squared over 4J squared. Why is that true? Well, when I expand this out in epsilon, which is a small number, even if phi is not a small number, epsilon is a small number. So I need epsilon phi is a small number. Then this becomes cosine phi plus epsilon phi sine phi, which is exactly what we have over there. And then by picking the coefficient epsilon correctly, when I multiply with this term, I'll recover exactly the right coefficient there. So this version of it tells you exactly what's happening. You've just changed the angular frequency of the harmonic oscillator. Okay, it was 1, but now it's 1 minus epsilon. And so this means that the harmonic oscillator frequency, well, let's call it the angular frequency, has shifted. So for the orbit to come back to the same point, we need to increase, phi must advance by 2 pi times 1 plus epsilon. The case, because the argument here is 1 minus epsilon 2 times phi, so if phi goes up to 2 pi, it'll be smaller than, if phi goes up to 2 pi, the argument won't be 2 pi, but if phi goes up to 2 pi times 1 plus epsilon, then this argument 2 order epsilon will be 2 pi. Okay, so 1 plus epsilon, so the argument will be 1 minus epsilon times 1 plus epsilon times 2 pi, which equals 2 pi to order epsilon squared, up to order epsilon squared. So what that means is phi has got to advance further. So if I try to sketch this, it means the orbit is not going to reach its closest point until the angle has increased further than 2 pi. Try and draw it properly. Okay, so basically the orbit is going to precess. And the change in delta phi per orbit is equal to 2 pi epsilon. So that's the advance of the perihelion. And as I mentioned last time, when you put the numbers for Mercury, delta phi is equal to 5 times 10 to the minus 7 radians per orbit. There are 415 for Mercury, so this is for Mercury. Okay, so for Mercury, all these parameters were measured, the ellipticity, the mass, the angular momentum. There are 415 orbits per year. And so this leads to 43. So the perihelion advances by 43 arcseconds per century. Perihelion advances by 43 arcseconds per century. And that was a wonderful coincidence to get that number, because that's exactly the anomaly that was known by astronomers from the 19th century. So this is tremendously humbling to see a theory with this level of success. Okay, and such theories are very, very few and far between. Our theories of cosmology, for example, are a long way from this. Okay, the theories we have of cosmology, in general, those theories have more parameters than the number of parameters you need to describe the observations. That's not a good situation to be in. It means you're not really predicting anything. You are parameterizing, but you're not actually predicting. So this is, I always tend to be rather harsh on theories, and I'm not very popular because of it, but I'm afraid a lot of people are working on theories where there are vastly more parameters than observable numbers. And I want to encourage people to try and work on theories where you actually get predictions. I think that's better science. Are there any questions?
I don't want to nitpick. I think you probably mean 415 orbits per century there, right?
Mercury
orbits by 450 times, 415 times for every Earth orbit.
That's not what I'm finding on the internet. I'm getting the periodization by every source I looked at.
You're saying it's periodization?
Because I looked it up, that sounded very fast, and then like if you just like work out those numbers, it must be percent, right?
Okay. I'll take your word for it.
Yeah,
I took this out of that
blue book. I'm pretty sure that's what they said, but you may be right. You're saying Mercury orbits four times faster than the Earth?
It says 88, I mean, Wikipedia says period is 88 days, and that is 415 a century.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right. So it's a monumental thing.
Okay. Thank you. That's not nitpicking, that's a fact.
415 for you, pretty relative.
Okay, sorry.
Thanks for that correction. I'm pretty sure that's in Houston and Todd, but I should have checked it myself. Any other questions? Okay, if no questions, then I'm going to go on to solutions to general relativity. And in fact, maybe I'll do it in a slightly different order. Yeah, I'll tell you what, I told you at the end of last week I was going to tell you where the stress energy tensor comes from. So let me do that first. And then I'm going to discuss other solutions of GR other than the Schwarzschild solution, in particular gravitational waves. This is one of the most important predictions. It really is a prediction, and which will be tested in the coming decade. So this is something many of you may be very interested in working on. And then we'll do black hole, we'll discuss the structure of the black hole, Schwarzschild black hole, possibly do the Kerr black hole, and possibly do something about cosmology. But I have to keep my promise to tell you where the stress energy tensor came from. So let me tell you that now. So the action for general relativity. So it turns out that the correct action for general relativity, as I've already indicated, but now I'm going to describe precisely, the action for general relativity is integral d4x root minus g times the Ricci scalar. Okay, so this is called the Einstein-Hilbert action. And I've already indicated there's only one scalar quantity in Riemannian geometry that describes the curvature of a space intrinsically to that space. And that's the Ricci scalar. And so this is essentially the only thing it could be. So now let's just vary it. I've, of course, picked the coefficient here. I've picked it because I know in advance what the relationship is between the action for the matter and the energy in the matter. And so we'll get to that in a moment, but I've picked this with hindsight, of course. You could just leave it a constant, and then you'd eventually infer that this constant was related to Newton's constant. So this is the only scalar involving only two derivatives. Involving two derivatives of the metric. Representing the curvature of space-time. So what we want to do is calculate the variation in the action. And so that would be the action evaluated on some g plus delta g minus the action evaluated on some g. By the way, this notation is a sort of functional notation. So if I've got S is not a function of g, it's a functional of g because it involves an integral over space of a function of g. And so often we denote that by a functional. It just tells you take the thing and put g plus delta g in there and subtract from it delta g. Subtract from it the same thing without the delta g. So we've got to learn how to vary all these expressions. And in particular, we've got to vary root minus g r. So this is equal to r, this is equal to the variation of root minus g times r. And then I've got to do the variation of r. So the way I'll do that is remember that r is equal to g mu nu r mu nu. So when I vary r, I should vary this guy and then vary that guy. So I get delta g mu nu times r mu nu plus root minus g g mu nu delta r mu nu. Now, the first two terms are pretty easy. These two terms are quite easy. If I've got a matrix and I vary it, we've already worked out formula for that. Yes.
Can you remind us exactly what it means that R is the only scalar involving two derivatives?
Well, we worked out we tried to construct tensors out of the metric. Okay, and the only thing you can do with it is differentiate it. I mean, you could take G mu nu, you can contract G mu nu with itself. And you'll get delta mu nu. It's not a particularly interesting tensor. Doesn't depend on anything. but so once you're done with contracting G with itself, you have to take derivatives of G. It's the only thing you can do. First derivative of G gives zero. Second derivative of G is the Riemann curvature. Okay, and so that incorporates all second derivatives of G that are meaningful. And now you say, given the Riemann curvature, how can I make scalars? Well, there's basically only one way, which is to contract the four indices of the Riemann curvature to form the Ricci scalar. I could, if I was allowed higher derivatives, you know, I could do things like this. That's also a scalar. But that involves four derivatives, not two derivatives. So the only scalar involving two derivatives which you can construct from the metric and its derivatives up to second order is the Ricci scalar.
So it seems like, for instance, you could just define some new scalar that was some function of R. And
yes.
That's, I guess, obvious. But so is the statement that you want to make that any other scalar that involves only two derivatives of the metric can be obtained from R, or
yes.
In fact, is f of R.
Is R, yeah. Well, not f of R.
Any function of R which isn't linear is going to have more than two derivatives. It's R plus R squared plus R cubed.
Doesn't it just have those derivatives squared? Or that's not.
Yes, it does, but that counts as higher derivatives.
Oh, okay.
If I write down an action which is x dot squared, we count that as involving two derivatives. If I wrote down x dot cubed, I would say that has three derivatives.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. So you can, there's nothing to stop you writing down f of r as an action, but it does depend on higher powers of derivatives, if you like. Yeah. So that's a distinction. I mean, you might say, why don't I just write this thing down? What you could do, it's a bit arbitrary, right? Because if I think of this as a series in R, it will go like constant plus R squared, right? And we're going to have, in fact, both of these terms. These will be important. If you introduce this term, there's, of course, a new parameter in here. So this is called R squared gravity. You can have R cubed gravity. If you introduce this guy, well, why don't you introduce that as well? It turns out there are several scalars, and at every order in derivatives, there are more and more and more scalars you could write down. Okay, so this would be Ricci squared, or you could have R mu nu, or you could have this one. They all involve the same number of derivatives. The feature of those, they involve higher derivatives. There's a sort of general argument that even if they are present, they should be small. And the reason is that if R is a small number, if the curvature of spacetime is small, then one can argue that these higher curvature terms would be smaller. Okay, so that's a sort of one argument in favor of just keeping the first term. It's more complicated than that, because if you keep the general second term, your equations of motion are not going to be second order anymore. And then the whole theory is very different in character. So you're sort of opening a big can of worms. Not that you can't, but it is a big can of worms. Any other questions? So it's certainly the simplest thing you can do to write down an action which only involves two derivatives of R, of the metric. Now, the first two terms in the variation are rather easy, so let me leave these till later. The complicated term is this one. Okay, because the Ricci tensor is this complicated thing, it will turn out when we're all done that the variation of this guy contributes nothing. Okay? And everything comes from these two terms. So, but we have to show that. So let's try and work out delta R mu nu. So we'll start from the definition of the Ricci tensor. And this is, of course, equal to gamma lambda mu nu comma lambda minus gamma lambda lambda mu comma nu plus gamma mu nu alpha gamma alpha lambda lambda minus gamma alpha mu lambda alpha nu. Okay, so that involves derivatives of gamma with the gamma gamma terms. So now we do our variation, delta R mu nu. And so what I get is delta gamma lambda lambda, lambda lambda mu comma nu minus delta gamma lambda mu lambda comma nu. And then I've got to vary these guys, so I'm going to get four terms. Delta gamma alpha mu lambda gamma lambda alpha nu. Actually, let me write the other ones down first. Plus delta gamma mu nu alpha gamma alpha lambda plus gamma alpha mu nu delta gamma lambda alpha lambda. So this should all be obvious just from the line above. Delta gamma mu lambda alpha gamma lambda alpha nu minus gamma alpha mu lambda delta gamma lambda alpha nu. Well, this is not so bad because you've got delta gamma and this guy, delta gamma with these two indices contracted, has one free index. Okay, so it looks like a vector with a lowered index. And so you can associate one of these gamma terms with that as making up the covariant derivative. Oh, I think I wrote this wrong. I wrote this one wrong. Delta gamma, this is mu nu comma lambda. Right, I just varied that. Remember, derivatives commute. Partial derivatives commute, so actually variations commute with partial derivatives too. So I just varied this to get that. Now this guy has three indices. So if I try to make a covariant derivative of it, I would need three gamma terms. This one has one index. To make a covariant derivative, I would need one gamma term. And in fact, that's the way it works out. And I'll explain why in a moment. It's equal to delta gamma alpha mu nu semicolon alpha minus delta gamma lambda mu lambda semicolon nu. Okay, so when I vary r, what I get is the covariant derivative of delta gamma minus the covariant derivative of delta gamma, and that's everything. This is called a Palatini identity. So here's a question for you. Why is it that when I construct delta gamma, this thing turned out in terms of covariant derivatives of delta gamma? Remember, gamma is not a tensor, right? Gamma is not a tensor. That was the whole point of gamma. Gamma is introduced to cancel non-tensor terms in the second derivative. So it's not a tensor. What about delta gamma? Delta gamma is the difference between two gammas. Is it a tensor? Yeah, it's a tensor because the bad term cancels. Okay? So you varied a tensor, right? You had to get a tensor. It involves delta gamma. It has to be covariant derivative of delta gamma. Okay, so that all works out. All right, so now all we have to deal with is this last term. So we can write root minus g, g mu nu, delta r mu nu. So what do? I'm contracting with g, okay? Now, it's totally OK to bring the g inside the covariant derivatives, because the covariant derivative of g is 0. So you can bring the g inside. And what I am, so I can bring the g inside. Now, when I bring the g inside, it converts this quantity to a scalar, right? Because the g mu nu coming inside will make this into a scalar. A vector with only one index. So let's just do that. That is root minus g. And then we've got g mu nu delta gamma mu nu alpha semicolon alpha. And then over here, I've got, how do I want to write it? So then I'll do the same thing over here, root minus g. Yes. So bring the g inside here. That will convert this to a vector, g mu, let's write it this way, nu mu delta gamma lambda mu lambda, okay, semicolon nu. Okay, so both terms are of the form root minus g v alpha some vector semicolon alpha. Actually, the root minus g is outside. Doesn't really matter. But both terms are of this form. The covariant divergence of some vector. Okay, now there's a basic identity that when I have the covariant divergence of a vector, so now we can use v alpha semicolon alpha is equal to the following. The ordinary derivative plus gamma alpha beta v beta alpha. This gamma, where is the identity? Somewhere here. This gamma with an up and a down indices contracted is equal to one over root minus g times d beta of root minus g. Okay, so this is an identity. I'm not sure if you've done this. Did you do this in the example classes? Maybe you did? Okay. Sorry? Oh, you do it this afternoon. Okay, so you can prove that if I take my gamma and I contract the upper index with one lower index, you get this identity, just the derivative of g. And so what this means is that this is v alpha comma alpha plus d beta root minus g over root minus g times v beta. And so this is equal to d beta root minus g v beta over root minus g. Okay, so the covariant divergence of a vector can be written in terms of the ordinary derivative and root minus g. So both of these terms can be written that way. And so in fact, this is equal to the ordinary derivative, root minus g, g mu nu, delta gamma, mu nu alpha, comma alpha, okay, ordinary derivative, minus root minus g, g nu mu, gamma mu lambda, lambda, comma nu, i.e. it is a total divergence in the ordinary sense. Okay, by saying something's a total divergence, I just mean that it's the ordinary derivative of some quantity. And so when we vary the action, we end up with an expression like this. And now we can use the divergence theorem equals, using divergence theorem, the four-dimensional version of the divergence theorem. And this would be equal to integral v mu times ds mu, where, so this is some 4D volume. This is the 3D surface of that volume. And so if these quantities go to zero on the surface, then so therefore we get only surface terms. Okay, and the definition of our variational principle will be that if we do not vary things on the surface, so all the deltas, delta G, delta gamma, all those quantities vanish on the surface, then we can neglect. These can be neglected. Okay, so the big complicated term ends up giving nothing. And we can go back to the easy terms. Now, the easy terms, when I vary root minus g, what I get is 1/2 g mu nu, sorry, g upstairs mu nu, delta g mu nu. I think you've done this already. And you've also done the fact that if I vary the inverse metric, what I get is the negative of the variation of the lowered metric, okay, with where I raise the indices. So the variation of g with upstairs indices is just minus the variation of g with lower indices where I raise the indices. Okay. So this expression follows from the fact that the inverse metric times the metric is the delta. And delta doesn't vary. So when I vary the left-hand side, I've got to get zero. So the variation of this guy has to be somehow the opposite of the variation of this one. OK, so we can now do everything. The first term is the delta root minus g up there. And that gives me 1/2. G mu nu r. The second term gives me a minus sign because I'm varying the inverse metric. And then I raise the two indices on r mu nu with these two guys here. So this just gives me minus g mu nu r. And all this is multiplied by g mu nu. And there you have the Einstein tensor. So this, of course, is equal to minus the Einstein tensor. Okay, so it follows that delta S equals zero implies G mu nu equals zero, which are the Einstein equations. Now, we haven't included the matter yet. We've got to include the matter in the action. So the S will equal to the action, the gravitational action, which this gravitational action is 1 over 16 pi g integral root minus gr plus the matter action. Okay, and this is going to lead directly to the definition of the stress energy tensor. It will just be defined as whatever comes into the Einstein equations. Okay, so the matter action is going to depend on G and some fields, phi, A, psi, okay, all the other fields. But when we vary it, we don't care about that. We only care about its variation. Bring that one down. When we vary it, we only care about its variation with respect to a metric, because that's what gives the Einstein equations. So let's now vary it. So delta S total, or I just, yeah, let me call it S total. Delta S total is going to be integral d4x root minus g. And then here I've got minus g mu nu, delta g mu nu. And here I will have something times, there's a over 16 pi g. So here I've got something, and I'm just going to define it to be the stress energy tensor. Okay, so this is just the definition of T mu nu. T mu nu is whatever you get by varying the matter action with respect to G mu nu. And so when I set this equal to 0, you will see that G mu nu is 8 pi G T mu nu. Okay, so this definition of T mu nu obviously implies the stress energy tensor is conserved in the sense we used before, because we had these Bianchi identities which ensured that G mu nu was conserved. So the Bianchi identities d mu g mu nu equals 0 imply the conservation of stress energy d mu t mu nu equals 0. This is the covariant conservation. Okay, so it's all this just follows from the action formalism. And let's just do a couple of examples where you'll see what T mu nu is. Another way of writing this is that T mu nu is equal to 2 over root minus g delta s matter over delta g mu nu. And this guy is called the functional derivative. So s is a functional of g. When you vary it, the variation in x is going to involve delta g. And if you just define the coefficient of delta g to be this guy, this is the functional derivative, then that is the definition of the stress energy tensor. And so as long as your equations of motion are consistent, they will imply stress energy conservation of the matter. The equations of motion may not be consistent, in which case everything doesn't make any sense. But as long as they're consistent, this will stress energy conservation follows. Okay, so let's do a couple of examples. And let's take as the simplest thing we know of, the Higgs field. It's the simplest because it's a scalar, phi. And so it doesn't have any Lorentz indices, like unlike the fermions or the gauge bosons. And if I write down the action for it, it's got to be a scalar. So let's first of all write down the volume element. I'd like it to only involve two derivatives of the scalar. And so what can I write down that is a Lagrangian involving two derivatives of a scalar phi? Okay, so I can write down d mu phi. What? Covariant. I don't need covariant because covariant and ordinary are the same for scalars. This is d mu phi. Okay, so that's a vector. If I want to make a scalar, I can just contract it with another vector, right? So I can write down something like this, d mu phi d nu phi. This is equal to g mu nu ordinary derivative because there's no connection required for a scalar. Okay, and it turns out the usual convention is to write it this way, to just rescale phi so that the coefficient is 1/2 here, and then okay, and then you can also write down phi squared, or in fact any function of phi. Let's call it v of phi. Actually, I'm going to do that, minus v of phi. So both of those terms are scalars. This is the sort of kinetic term, roughly speaking. Okay, though actually it involves time derivatives as well as space derivatives. So it's a Lorentz invariant and general coordinate invariant kinetic term. And this second term is a potential term. And the whole quantity is a general coordinate scalar. So let us, in particular, you see, imagine this v didn't depend on phi at all. Maybe v was just a constant. If v is a constant, well, that's a scalar. A number is a scalar. And so if v is a constant, that represents a contribution to general relativity, to the action in general relativity. And it's the same constant that Einstein called a cosmological constant. Okay, you're free to add any constant. It's a matter of definition whether I put it into the v and call that the value, a constant contribution to the scalar field potential, or if I treat it as another constant. So whenever we write down the Higgs potential, you know, we have a freedom to put it wherever we like. We can scale up and down. And the constant freedom is the cosmological constant, also called the dark energy. And at the present time, we have no idea what determines that constant. It's certainly very, very, very important what that constant is. And we don't really have good theories of which would determine its value. Anyhow, let's work out the stress energy tensor, T mu nu. So I've got to vary this with respect to G. And I'll leave that for you as an exercise. T mu nu for a scalar field is d mu phi d nu phi. So these here just mean that I've raised the indices using the metric, taken the ordinary derivative and raised the index using the metric, minus 1/2 g mu nu g alpha beta d alpha phi d beta phi. That half should actually be here, minus V. Actually, it's plus V. And for Maxwell's theory in curved space-time, we have d4x root minus g. The action is just minus 1/4 f mu nu f alpha beta. And now you need to use metrics to raise those indices and contract them, g nu beta, where f mu nu is defined to be the covariant derivative of a nu minus the covariant derivative of a mu. Okay, so that's just generalizing what we did in flat space. The field strength is this anti-symmetrized derivative of the vector potential that happens to be equal to the ordinary derivative. So you can easily check that the connection terms cancel in this case, d nu a mu. They always cancel in anti-symmetrized derivatives of anti-symmetric tensors. The connection terms will always cancel. And then if I vary that Maxwell term with respect to G to work out the stress tensor, I will get exactly the expression for the stress tensor, which we had right at the beginning of the course. So 2 over root minus G delta S delta G mu nu gives you the T mu nu, which we had at the start of the course. Final example is the point particle. And so you've already dealt with this in the examples classes. You've used its stress energy tensor, point particle. S is equal to minus m integral d lambda root minus g mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda. Now, there's only one thing you have to be careful here. This is g mu nu of x of lambda, right? You use the metric along the curve the particle is following. So if I want to vary this with respect to g, I want to do this functional derivative, right? But the functional derivative is only defined if this is an integral over spacetime of something that depends on g of x, right? So what I do is rewrite it in this way, integral d4x, integral d lambda, delta function, four-dimensional delta function of x minus x of lambda. Okay, again, I'm not putting the indices inside the function, but really this is a function of four variables, t, x, y, z, and it sets each one of them equal to the trajectory of the particle. I would have a root minus g here to make that coordinate invariant. Actually, I don't need it. Sorry, no, this is an identity. This is already coordinate invariant, so I don't need that. This integral over delta 4x is just going to set the argument of g equal to x of lambda, right? So x dx nu d lambda dx nu d lambda. All right, so that's equal to an action function now, which is a functional of g mu nu of x and also of x of lambda. But when I vary this with respect to take the functional variation, you will get, you'll just recover the stress energy tensor varying with respect to delta G, with respect to G, you recover the stress energy tensor we used. Used early in the course. Okay, and this delta function just tells you that the stress energy is localized where the particle is. Any questions? So I think, as I already mentioned, you know, this seems too slick to be true, okay? All right, we're trying to define energy and momentum, these very deep and fundamental quantities, and all I do is introduce some metric and vary with respect to the metric, and bingo, I have them. But the point is, that is all built in. When you make a theory which is invariant under general coordinate transformations, a subset of those transformations include shifts in space to give energy conservation, shifts in time to shifts in space to give momentum conservation, shifts in time to get energy conservation. It's all built in, okay? And stress energy conservation just emerges in a completely trivial way when you work in this general relativistic framework. So it turns out that even if you're not interested in gravity, if you're interested in quantum field theory, and you want to talk about the stress energy tensor in a quantum field theory, it's an extremely useful tool to imagine putting that quantum field theory into a curved space and then having an action which depends on it, varying it, getting the stress tensor, and then set the metric equal to flat space. So even when you're working in flat space, this is very, very useful. This is the best definition of the stress energy tensor. Just take your theory, put it in curved space, vary it, okay, calculate the stress energy, put it back to flat space. That's the stress energy tensor. And maybe that was the start of all kinds of reasoning. I mean, you may be aware people are now interested in topological field theories and topological order. And so people said, well, if I'm going to put a theory into a curved space in order to better understand it, why don't I put it into a topologically more interesting space, okay? We want to understand it in real spaces, but maybe it's actually better to put it on a torus or a sphere or some other complicated topology. And then you discovered all sorts of properties of field theory, like topological order, like an order which reflects the space you put it on. And this is very much sort of what at the cutting edge of research today. So yes, it all looks a bit too slick to be true, but it is a very powerful method, and it sort of supersedes everything we did before. Yes.
An electromagnetic contribution to the stress energy tensor.
That
seems like would be possible. So that would. So what's the physical significance of that? Like.
So we're going to infer from this the Einstein equations, and then when I put the electromagnetic fields in, I'm going to have things like, you know. Minus g mu nu times f squared. So there will be terms on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. So these are the electromagnetic field is a source for the Einstein equations.
Right, so
okay.
What is that supposed to,
what does it do?
What does that mean?
Well, for example, we solved
physically.
It's huge. It makes massive differences. It means you've got an electric field in space or a magnetic field. So, you know, before we solved the Einstein equations to get the Schwarzschild geometry. That was the vacuum Einstein. This is the non-vacuum Einstein. So when you solve so imagine I've got a mass which doesn't just have mass, it has charge, okay, electric charge. That means that there has to be an electric field going out from this mass, okay? And the electric field has stress energy, so it will change the Einstein equations. So when you solve for spherical symmetry in the presence of electromagnetic field and a charge, what you find is another metric called the Reissner-Nordström. Metric. And the Reissner-Nordström metric describes a charged black hole. Okay, it's just totally different. And everything about it is different. It has electric fields. So that's one example.
And then in turn, though, even if you had, like, for example, a non-charged sort of test particle in this space-time, it would have different equations of motion?
No, not if the field strength is zero, it's not going to affect the Einstein equations. Mm-hmm. And if the field strength is zero, it's not going to affect the motion of the particle. Because remember, the motion of the particle was d2x mu d tor squared. Is f mu nu x, you know, dx nu dtor.
I think what Dylan is asking is if the black hole is charged, there's a non-charged test particle moving around it.
Everything. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. The orbits will all be shifted by the charge. Now, in the real universe, you don't find electrically charged stars or black holes. And the reason is that charge can, in fact, the real reason is that the electric force is very strong, right? The electric force between two charged particles is really strong and much stronger than the gravitational force, stronger by orders of magnitude. And for that reason, electric fields can rip particles away from gravitational fields very easily. That's why we're all neutral. Okay, we're made out of charged particles, but as objects as a whole, we're electrically neutral. If we were not, you know, if I was charged, I would just suck all of your electrons away from all of you guys and from the air until I became neutral, because the electric force is so strong. The gravitational force can't really resist that. It's very weak. In fact, this is the hierarchy problem. Okay, that the gravitational force between two particles goes like this, two particles of mass m, whereas the electric force goes like q squared over r squared, right? The Coulomb force. Now, this number is of order 1. Electric charge is a 1. This is determined by the fine structure constant, which is 1 over 137. okay, in natural units. This is, however, the mass over the Planck mass squared. Planck mass is 10 to the 19 times the mass of a proton. So this number is tiny. The gravitational force between two particles is infinitesimal compared to the electric force. So electric force determines the structure of matter, the atoms, you know, all the stuff around us, rips all charges away from gravitational fields, and the net result is that almost everything is neutral in the universe. You could ask, what's the total charge of the universe? Okay. And it turns out there's a Gauss law constraint which forces it to be zero. So if you have a closed universe, and you say, just as an example, imagine the universe is a three-sphere. Can I put electric charge in it? No. The total charge must be zero. It follows from Gauss's equation that div E equals rho. That if I integrate the right-hand side, I'll get the total charge in the universe. If I integrate the left-hand side, it's a divergence. And if there's no surface term, it has to be zero. So the universe has to be, as a whole, has to be electrically neutral. So if I put charge on a black hole, I've got to have taken it out of something else. And that black hole is just going to take the charge back and neutralize itself. So that's why we don't see Riesner-Nordström black holes. We don't even see Schwarzschild, but that's because we see rotating black holes, which are Kerr black holes. Yeah.
Have experiments ever seen curvature due to electromagnetic energy?
That's a good question. I don't. Well, only indirectly. Okay. Indirectly in the following sense. In cosmology, near the Big Bang, the universe went through a radiation-dominated era. Okay, I hope we'll do that in the last lecture. But I don't want to start talking about cosmology, because if I start, I won't stop. Okay, because that's my interest. Okay, so basically, our picture of the universe is that at early times, it's dominated by radiation. And the radiation controlled the expansion rate of the universe. So photons, neutrinos, these were dominant in the early universe. And to the extent that we understand the early universe, all of that depends on this contribution to the stress tensor of the stuff in the universe at early times. And it all works amazingly. So when we calculate the abundance of the elements in cosmology, we calculate how much helium, deuterium, and lithium formed in the Big Bang. We get the right answers by using this. So we're pretty confident this is correct. But if you ask, can I see today evidence of gravitational fields caused by electromagnetic fields? I don't think so. Black holes do generate big magnetic fields, but I think they're not strong enough to warp the metric. Louis Lehner would be the expert to ask on that. My suspicion is no. Any other questions? Yeah, so cosmology is really spectacular because it tests everything about these equations. Okay. And it has amazing successes, like the cosmic microwave background radiation, the perturbations, their evolution into galaxies and stars. But it has huge puzzles as well, which is that the metric we live in came out of a singularity. Okay? And so it came out of a place where Einstein's equations fail, where all of space was a point. And so cosmology is the best clue we have that what happens to Einstein when you take it to extremes. We know it falls apart. Any other questions? Okay. Is there a class this afternoon?
Yes.
There is. Okay.
It will be varying
A what?
Varying the Einstein-Hilbert.
Oh, very good.